That's Stevie Wonder. I'm Tavis Smiley. I'm delighted to have you with us in this hour. And in this hour, two conversations on the B-side of this hour. On Saturday, South Africa celebrated 30 years since the end of apartheid. We will talk about how far South Africa has come in meeting its freedom goals on the backside of this hour, with former Clinton administration ambassador Charles R. Stith, who also serves as the non-executive chairman of the African Presidential Leadership Center in Joburg. But we commence this hour with Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman on the Trump trials, the escalating war in Ukraine, and his cameo in the series finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Colonel Vindman, good to have you on the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Tavis. Thanks for having me on, and passing out a load from my wife, who's a fan of yours, Rachel.
Oh, thank you, Rachel. I appreciate that. I take all the love I can get anywhere I can get it. So thank you for that. Let me just jump right in first on the Ukraine issue. And the word Ukraine hasn't come out of my mouth for a few days, in part because what is in front of it is Israel, Hamas, Donald Trump, Joe Biden. It almost seems, and this is the way the news cycle works, as you well know, you have all these conflicts around the globe at the same time, but some things get pushed off the front pages. What is it over the last few weeks, specifically about Ukraine, the war in Ukraine, that we've been missing, focused on these other things that you want to refocus us on in this moment?
Sure. So let me first say, I think they're all kind of connected. Mm-hmm. We tend to think of these things as kind of in geographically disparate, you know, Middle East, Europe, Eurasia, the U.S. There's actually a bigger systemic struggle between the authoritarian regimes, the tyrants, the dictators around the world, and an opportunity they see to advance their interests versus democracy and the gains democracy has made, certainly since World War II, and probably more so since the end of the Cold War in 1991. So I think these things are connected. You don't have Iran launching attacks against Israel without being emboldened by Russia upsetting the apple cart in Europe. You don't have kind of these kinds of aggressive moves in the Pacific without a opportunity presented by a general erosion in kind of norms and rules of the road in the world. But with regards to Ukraine specifically, because it is the driver behind a lot of these other systems, a lot of these other systemic threats. Ukraine's been under pressure. I mean, today, if you're watching closely, Russia is making some tactical gains, inching forward. Ukraine is the largest country in Europe, but Russia has been making, meters, 100 meters, kilometers, grabs in territory because the U.S. wasn't able to come through with the kind of support that that we said we were going to provide since the beginning of this war. As long as it takes was the rhetoric coming out of the White House, but we weren't able to follow up through on that because the absolute utter chaos of the Republican Party just freezing everything for the past 6 months. And Russia took advantage of this. I mean, it's a microcosm of the bigger issue that when the West is weak, when the West is distracted, Russia will advance. Russia will seek out those opportunities, widen fractures. They do that with regards to the rhetoric in our own politics, in our own policies. They're certainly doing that, in this important battlefield in Ukraine. So that's what's been going on. I've been breathing a bit of a sigh of relief over the past couple of days because we finally did pass this $61 billion aid project. And we should look at it not as all this money going to Ukraine, most of that money staying here, but we should look at that as a way to buy down the risk of U.S. troops ending up in Europe. Mm-hmm. That's what's so important about providing support to Ukraine.
I hear your point loud and clear. I'm not so sure Americans see it that way. I'm not so sure they buy that line. When we come forward, let's interrogate that line. Mm-hmm. I hear it coming out of your mouth. I'm just not so sure the American public is sold on that, number one. Number two, beyond the drama in the Republican Party and why it took so long to get this $61 billion approved for Ukraine, there is the question of whether or not Americans writ large have Ukraine fatigue, and that's just Ukraine. I haven't gotten to the Trump trials and other issues I want to cover in this half hour with Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who you're listening to right now on Tavis Smiley.
From the Merck Park with love, this is Tavis Smiley. helping to make you the most knowledgeable person in your circle of friends. This is Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley and Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman of the Vindman Group. Before I get back to Ukraine, Colonel Vindman, let me come first to a point you made a few moments ago about the tempering, as it were, of the spread of democracy around the globe. Let me just come more direct. One could argue, looking at a map, looking at a globe right now, one could argue that democracy is on the ropes, sir.
I think you could I would agree with that, is the bottom line. I think the fact is that you have a convergence of powers around the globe, Russia and China, China being a massive economic power, huge population, that are working together with smaller powers like Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, to provide an alternative to democracy. Democracy looked like it won the Cold War, emerged the U.S. as the sole superpower for a moment, and there was not really a lot of ways that the remaining authoritarian regimes looked like they could come together or partner or advance. I think the fact is that we took our eye off the ball. The 20 years of war in the Middle East against terrorism allowed places like Russia, like China, to garner their strength and kind of rebound, resurge, and this is their moment. It kind of reminds me a little bit of, you know, so, you might know Kelly Robinson from Human Rights Campaign. Mm-hmm. She's a Kettering fellow with me. And I heard her speak beautifully about why we're facing so many challenges within our democracy today. And she basically made the point, it's because we've come so far. And I think that's kind of a good metaphor for the fact that democracy has advanced over the past 30 years. A lot of people have been taken out of poverty around the globe, but the forces of regression, the forces of kind of historical dictators, are looking to score some points and accelerate. So I think that's part of the story. You know, we keep progressing, but we're now experiencing a step back. If that makes sense.
No, I mean philosophically, I was wrestling with that as you shared it. It makes sense philosophically. I get it. Intellectually, and yet practically, I think that argument only goes so far. Because when you look, for example, at Donald Trump, let me pivot to Trump, and I promise I'll come back to Ukraine. Yeah. But you look at Donald Trump, the damage that he has done, some of it one could argue is even irreparable. But the damage that he has done to this experiment in democracy has nothing to do with how far we've come. It has to do with his arrogance, with his petulance, with his authoritarian views. I could run the list, but that's not about how far democracy's come. It's about allowing someone in with those kinds of views and giving them access to the reins of power. That only happens when a significant number of fellow citizens empower him by voting for him to have that sort of access. That's got nothing to do with how far we've come. That's just regressive politics all the way around.
I don't know. I guess I see it a little bit differently. I think it is the fact that we've had so many the flourishing of rights for the LGBT community. I think it's because we've probably made some gains with regards to being a more kind of inclusive society, that there are regressive forces that are on the losing end of that power, mm-hmm. that are looking to pick somebody like Donald Trump that would take us backwards. And I think it is a story of the fact that we're it's hard to see it because we're in a fight right now.
Yeah.
And what's on the horizon with this election will determine whether we do continue to march towards that more perfect union. I know it's a little bit flowery, but do we go backwards? And I think the fact is that the long arc of maybe U.S. history seems to be taking us forward with these moments of regression. I guess I have quite a bit of confidence that we're going to make the right decision. I see that in election results, special elections, that really kind of mind-blowing outcome in Alabama, where Trump won by 30 points, and then Democratic challenger in a special election won by 18 because there was a concerted effort to take away reproductive rights, to infringe on kind of in vitro fertilization and people's desires to have families. I think that's where we are seeing the forces of regression launch a keen concerted assault to take us back because we were making progress.
No, I take the argument. My only point, we'll move on. I want to cover some other stuff in the time I have left. My only point in what I said a moment ago was to suggest the following, that Donald Trump is not some rogue dictator who has a band of rebels in some small banana republic that under the cover of darkness came and took over the reins of power. That's not how this happened.
Yep.
To the extent that Donald Trump got elected the first time and to the extent he could get reelected this time, it's because millions, 70 million plus fellow citizens empowered him to do that. And I hear your argument about, you know, you take one step forward in democracy, two steps backwards. I get it. It's a struggle. Freedom is a never-ending meeting. I understand that part. I'm just making the point that if he pulls this off, it's because a bunch of other Americans who say they believe in democracy, who say they believe in freedom, who say they believe in et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, empowered him to do that. And I digress. That's my point. It's not just some rogue dictator grabbing power through military might. So we agree on that point.
Yeah.
Let me pivot right quick. Back to Ukraine swiftly here. If I said to you that I see data that suggests to me that Americans writ large are suffering right now, not just Republicans, but Americans writ large are suffering from Ukraine fatigue, you'd say what?
I would say that I've seen some of the same polling, and I would say that it's largely bad polling in how you ask the question. For instance, if you say, should we give Ukraine a blank check, should we give Ukraine money? The answer is, by and large, going to be no. But if you say, should we support Ukraine, a struggling democracy, fending off an authoritarian regime, you get a different kind of answer. And we live in a representative democracy. So technically, our representatives are supposed to kind of fall in line with what the people's will is. And what we saw in this passage of the Ukraine aid bill is an overwhelming support, somewhere in the ballpark of 75% of Congress voted for it. And the good polling that I've seen actually stays relatively consistent with that. You have, somewhere in the band of 65 to 75% of the American public still supports Ukraine. But there is a big, busy, busy agenda, whether it's the Middle East, whether it's the most important thing, which is the health of our own democracy and our elections, or any number of crises that pop up. It's hard for us to maintain focus for more than 2 years on something that seems an ocean away. So I think there is some of that. I just think it tends to be a little overstated. And by and large, I think the Ukrainian struggle, a struggle for democracy, that the underdog story, that all kind of still resonates with the American public by and large. But there has been some erosion. Yes.
Yep. So I would respond by saying to you that the polling also suggests that most Americans believe that we can and should do better by our babies, do better by our children. So if you ask them that question, they say yes. But when it comes to actually funding things like the child tax credit, it's an uphill battle every time. And so the rub for me is that Americans want to export democracy. I get that. And so we keep cutting these checks to Ukraine. I get that. The latest check, $61 billion, to the point that you made earlier. But you have to fight like the devil to get anywhere near that, not even close to that, for something like the child tax credit. And I think that says something about this democracy as well, does it not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a shame that we have rhetoric around the fact that we care for life in swaths of this country, but that only seems to matter, while there's a fetus in the uterus, and then afterwards we don't seem to care so much. Mm-hmm. So it is a shame. We have a 27 trillion dollar economy, the largest in the world. We have the ability to do multiple things at the same time, but we can't seem to prioritize. And I think it's just the broader paralysis in our system that is not allowing us to do things that the Biden administration has actually, by and large, been extremely successful in. It's been maybe one of the most successful in a generation or longer with regards to implementing policies that really advance and improve the lot of everyday Americans, whether that's, bring back industrial manufacturing, whether that's inflation reduction. There's just been so many different things we could do. And I think a second Biden administration especially if we're able to win back the House, may see a huge gain on the policy and legislative side that could really kind of prove the worth of the Democrats in a way that somehow hasn't translated as well as it should. But yeah, I think we could do both. The overseas investments are to make sure that we don't have to spend huge resources on a costly war. In that, stability in Europe, which is our largest trading partner, is important for economic growth, but we can't forsake all the things we should be doing for our own population. We have the resources to do it, and we just don't.
Yeah, I would argue, we don't have time to have this argument, but I would argue if we had the time that we're already spending billions of dollars on a war. We're engaged in a couple of different proxy wars right now. So we may not have boots on the ground, but one could argue, I think, credibly and forcefully and maybe even accurately that we're engaged in a couple of proxy wars right now. I digress on that for now. Let me ask you a question that I've not asked of anybody else. I haven't talked to anybody in the last few days that has the frame, that operates inside the frame that you do. So the work of the Vindman Group is international, not just domestic. And so since we've been talking about international politics, let me ask you what your read is, what your sense of, as you talk to folk around the globe, what your sense is of the way that they, the people outside of this country, around the world, are watching these Trump trials. We have these conversations, of course, inside of our border about the way we see these trials, these indictments unfolding little by little. But what's your sense of the way the world sees a former U.S. president? Again, I used the phrase banana republic earlier. You see this kind of stuff all the time in banana republics and other places around the world that are less civilized. I'm putting civilized in air quotes right now. You can't see me. This is radio. Less civilized countries around the world. But what's your sense of how the world is watching these Trump trials?
I'll tell you, there is a deep sense of anxiety. And I think, frankly, many think we've lost our minds. We've lost our way. We've lost our minds. That we elected a president that, frankly, a lot of this stuff was already known and had occurred before this, right? This is not like since he was in office, this, Stormy Daniels stuff or later. I mean, plenty of things happened afterwards, but we elected somebody like this. And now for the whole world to see, this is who the Americans, pick to be their national leader. So I think there is deep anxiety that somebody like this could end up back in power, the leader of the free world, as we were known, and people are kind of in a bit of a panic.
Yeah.
So this question comes up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
What are the chances that Trump could be president again? We survived one Trump term. I think if he ends up in office again, we will have lost. I don't know if we could recover. But we would have lost a generation of credibility around the world if we could ever recover from it. So it would be a terrible, terrible tragedy.
Yeah, I was going to ask this question. Let me press forward anyway, because it's a slight tweak on what you just said. What would the message be to the world? We were talking earlier about democracy and how one could look at a map of the globe and make a credible argument. The democracy right now is on the ropes. What kind of message would it send to the world community after being indicted that Donald Trump could be reelected in this country?
It would mean that democracies around the world are on their own. It would mean that we would be kind of in a world of the rules of the jungle where the strong could play on the weak. And you could see some democracies banding together more effectively to resist. But even so, that's hard to fathom in places like the Pacific. So you could see people making compromises with authoritarian regimes, maybe even adjusting their own systems to accommodate those regimes. In Europe, I think the fact is that you already see some trend lines. The president of France, Emmanuel Macron, has already voiced that Europe has to be much more muscular and can't rely on the U.S. The U.S. is unreliable in certain regards. So I think the message would be to our enemies. This is your moment. To our friends, you're on your own. Do what you can.
Mm-hmm. I got about 60 seconds here. Tell me about this cameo in the series finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
I actually haven't watched it yet, but it was fun. That is an awesome crew and an awesome cast. It was a pleasure to do something so outside of my comfort zone and then learn that, you know, my comfort zone should probably be expanded. So it was a good time. Glad to be a part of that. You know, my daughter says I can't act. You know, I'd like to, I try to prove that otherwise, but it was fun. I'm glad I got a chance to do it. And I'll be out in LA, you know, for visiting some friends here and some family in the coming weeks. Maybe see if I could reconnect with those folks from Curb.
No, it was a long-running series, had a huge success, and a high honor for you to have been involved in the series finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. He runs the Vindman Group, and I've delighted in having him on this program to discuss some international issues as well as stuff on the domestic agenda. Colonel Vindman, all the best to you, sir. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
When we come forward, Saturday, over the weekend, they celebrated the 30th anniversary of the end of apartheid in South Africa. Believe it or not, 3 decades ago, this historic election took place in South Africa, which brought to an end the era of apartheid. We'll talk about that with Ambassador Charles R. Stith when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
Unapologetically progressive. Unapologetically black. You're tapped into Tavis Smiley.